Hello and welcome to Prehistory, the Archaeology of the Ancient Near East. My name is Jane and today I want to tell you what we know about the Middle to Upper Paleolithic transition. Over the last few weeks, we've looked at what we know about the lives of anatomically modern humans and Neanderthals across the Near East during the Middle Paleolithic. We talked about how humans moved out of Africa to live in the Levant and the Arabian Peninsula. We saw how humans seem to have been replaced by Neanderthals in the Levant after about 75,000 years ago, but we're less certain what happened to humans in Arabia after this point. We talked about how we might think about Neanderthals, how there are good arguments for thinking of them a lot like how we think of ourselves. They lived much like we humans did at the time. They lived in small groups, they moved around, hunting and gathering plants, they decorated themselves with ornaments, and they buried their dead. We humans did all of these things also. This week, we look at the end of the Middle Paleolithic and the beginning of the Upper Paleolithic. We will also say goodbye to our cousins the Neanderthals and wonder what may have happened to them in the Near East. I don't think it's much of a spoiler to give away what ultimately happened to Neanderthals. We humans are currently around, and they aren't, so we can all mostly guess the ending. How we think of the end of the Neanderthals in the Near East has a lot to do with how we see them, and also how we think about us humans in the Upper Paleolithic. Because the Upper Paleolithic is, in essence, the return of humans, now modern humans, rather than just anatomically modern humans, into both Asia and Europe, beginning here in the Near East. There have been times in the past when archaeologists were very certain as to what happened with Neanderthals and humans. In the 19th century, when Neanderthals were first discovered, they were assumed to be an ancestor of ours. So, they came first, we evolved from them, and that's the end of that. Then, of course, we did more digging and realized that we were wrong. So, what then happened to the Neanderthals? Well, there came to be two, or even three, arguments about this. The first is that Neanderthals died out before humans arrived, and we spread out over a nice empty landscape. Very few people argue this anymore, and we'll see why in a bit. Another argument is that humans arrived, met the Neanderthals, had babies with them, and then sort of grew together into a single species, which is now us. The other side of this is the argument that humans arrived, killed off all the Neanderthals, and then had the whole area to ourselves. Okay, maybe not killed off all the Neanderthals, maybe we just drove them out of the good hunting grounds and left them to starve. Although, I'm not sure which of these is supposed to be the rosier option. It was these two arguments which have gone back and forth in archaeology for ages. Then, about 10 years ago, we got a complete sequence of Neanderthal DNA. Not too long after that, we realized that we humans also have Neanderthal DNA. Everywhere that Neanderthals used to live, and then some, shows up in us humans as an average of 2% of our DNA coming from Neanderthals. So, clearly, we met the Neanderthals and had babies with them, and that's where they all went. Argument solved, right? Of course not. You can't expect someone to change a lifetime's worth of argument just because of a pesky 2% of DNA. And this is the issue. Not just people having set views, that's an issue too. No, it's that we have only 2% of our DNA from Neanderthals. If we had interbred with Neanderthals to the point that they disappeared as a separate species, we would expect to have a higher percentage of our DNA coming from them. So now the arguments have mixed. Some humans definitely had babies with Neanderthals, but that doesn't mean that some humans also did not go on a Neanderthal killing spree. It's not nice, but sometimes neither are we. If we think about our past with Neanderthals, both of these arguments are probably right to some extent. Whether we mostly got together with the Neanderthals or killed them probably varied based on where you were, with different groups of humans and Neanderthals having different reactions to one another. Trying to figure out what happened when humans and Neanderthals met, and if we ever actually met in the Near East, is why the change from the Middle to the Upper Paleolithic in the Near East gets its own episode. That's because this transition, depending on how you date it, lasts anywhere from 10 to 15,000 years and takes us from a Near East dominated by Neanderthals to a Near East entirely peopled by humans. The difficulty with this changeover from Neanderthals to humans is not that archaeologists haven't been interested. We absolutely have. It isn't even that we haven't been able to find sites where we have both Middle Paleolithic material and material from the beginning of the Upper Paleolithic, because we have a few of those too. Not as many as we would like, but archaeologists always want more sites. We're greedy that way. No, one of the big problems that we had for a long time was dating. I'm not saying that archaeologists have trouble meeting people. I mean that we have had a lot of trouble figuring out the age of sites that we were excavating and studying. There are a lot of ways that we can tell the age of things in the archaeological record. These almost always give a range of dates, with whatever we're dating coming from a year somewhere within that range. That's because each method which we use for dating has an error range on either side of the date calculated. Different methods have error ranges of different sizes, and most methods only work within a particular time frame. The most common method used for dating in archaeology is what we call radiocarbon dating, which measures the decay of carbon isotopes, specifically the decay of carbon-14 into carbon-12. Anything alive absorbs both of these during their lifetime, and the amount of carbon-14 will be the same as the amount which is around in the atmosphere when the plant or the animal is alive. After this plant or animal dies, carbon-14 slowly decays into carbon-12. The decay of carbon-14 into carbon-12 happens at a known rate, so by determining the ratio of these two isotopes, we can figure out how long ago a particular plant or animal died. This method was figured out in the middle of the 20th century and has been used in archaeology pretty much right from its development as a way of working out how old things are. There are two downsides. The first is that the amount of carbon-14 in the atmosphere hasn't always been the same, so we have to calibrate radiocarbon dates in order to correct for this. We did not figure that out until after we'd been doing radiocarbon dating for a couple of decades, so our dates used to be a bit less precise than we might have thought. Although, considering that before this was invented, most of the dating in prehistory was pretty broad. That's a nice way of saying that for large areas of prehistoric archaeology, the absolute age of a lot of sites was pretty much guesswork. Early radiocarbon dating wasn't perfect, but it was, and still is, a big deal. The other downside is that radiocarbon dating only really works up until the ratio of carbon-12 to carbon-14 becomes too small to calculate. Eventually, the remains of plants and animals run out of carbon-14. And we stopped being able to use this technique. In the early days, this was roughly 40,000 years ago. Now, before I say anything else, have a guess. How far back in time do you think the Middle to Upper Paleolithic transition was? Yes, you are completely right. We would excavate a lovely sequence of Upper Paleolithic material from a site and get nice radiocarbon dates from 32,000 years ago, from 35,000 years ago, from 38,000 years ago, and then below this, we would still have Upper Paleolithic material, but the dates would only come back as the equivalent of big error messages. This was unbelievably frustrating. It was also really frustrating for anyone doing research in the Middle Paleolithic, as everything that I've talked about before today, in human evolution, in the Lower Paleolithic, and in the Middle Paleolithic, including the early presence of anatomically modern humans in the Near East, all of this used to be a big blank as far as the actual dates. The skeletons of anatomically modern humans in the Levant from the earlier stages of the Middle Paleolithic were at first thought to come from the very end of the Middle Paleolithic and were thought to represent the replacement of Neanderthals with humans rather than the other way around. It was the ability to date them that has changed the way that we look at the Middle Paleolithic over the last 20 to 30 years. We have gotten better at radiocarbon dating. New ways of preparing and processing samples and advances in the technology means that we can now push the threshold of dating back to about 50,000 years. But that still doesn't quite solve everything. Fortunately, we have developed other methods of dating things which were too old for radiocarbon dating. Well, some we archaeologists developed and some we borrowed from geology and paleontology. These days, we have a lot of options for dating, depending on what materials we have at a particular excavation and what sort of age range we think our site is. This is a big list, and I don't have time to go through all of it today, but there is one fairly recent one which is becoming common in archaeology, and that I will mention. Optically stimulated luminescence, or OSL, measures the amount of time that has passed since a particular bit of sediment, or dirt, has been exposed to sunlight. This is great because it means that we can actually date dirt. Pretty much every excavation has dirt, and it's not something that we tend to keep a lot of to study, so we're generally happy to part with some of it in order to get a date. Of course, you have to take an OSL sample without any of the dirt which you want to test getting exposed to the sun. It's not actually that hard. We have sampling kits, which is basically a short length of pipe with a cap on either end. You take the cap off of one end, get into your excavation trench, find part of the side of the trench, usually near the bottom, as you tend to want to sample the layer that you just excavated, and then you push the end of the pipe without the cap sideways into the dirt. This can take a little bit of force, but having it near the ground also helps because then you can take the extremely delicate and technical approach of kicking it repeatedly. You then pull or dig the pipe out of the dirt and put the second cap back on. Then, when you send this OSL sample off to a specialist lab, they study the dirt in the middle of the pipe, which has been kept protected from the sun. This has been a big help for dating mid-Paleolithic sites, which are almost all outside the range of radiocarbon dating. We still have a lot of sites which were excavated before we were able to improve radiocarbon dating, or before these new methods developed of being able to date things like the dirt itself. This is a problem because, apart from the fact that we don't have the actual protected bits of dirt to date for OSL, even something like radiocarbon dating is an issue. Because any type of dating costs money, and if the site was excavated a while ago and all of the material that was found is still in storage, then you have to both find a way to get permission to get access to the material and to destroy a little bit of it for dating, and you have to find a way to get the money to pay for a lab to do the dating. So while we have a much better picture of the age of sites, we still don't have absolute dates for all of the sites that we've excavated. And for most sites, we only have a few dates because, like I said, dates cost money. We know that in the later parts of the Middle Paleolithic, we have Neanderthals all over the Near East. Some of these sites only have material from the Middle Paleolithic, but some of them also have more recent material on top. We have a range of sites all the way from southern Jordan to the Caucasus and eastwards into central Iran. Not masses, but enough sites, where we have a long sequence of Upper Paleolithic deposits on top of the Middle Paleolithic Neanderthal deposits. Now, the Upper Paleolithic lasted for a while, so not all of the Upper Paleolithic deposits that we found sitting on top of Middle Paleolithic ones are from the early parts of the Upper Paleolithic. Some of them are, though. In each of these parts of the Near East, and from some of the bits in between, we have at least one site which has Upper Paleolithic material on top of earlier Upper Paleolithic material on top of really, really early Upper Paleolithic material, which is on top of Middle Paleolithic material. The name of this earliest material varies a bit depending on where you are in the Near East, but we can generally think of it as the initial Upper Paleolithic. So this is great. It's simple. We have good ways to date things, and we have some sites with a critical bit where the Middle Paleolithic turns into the Upper Paleolithic. So all we need to do is to get the date for that change, and then have a look at the material, and we'll know what happened to the Neanderthals. Well, that would be nice, but of course, that's not what we have. What we have are a lot of gaps. We have early Upper Paleolithic sites proper, starting about 40,000 years ago, with some small variation in the dates based on what region of the Near East we're looking at. Earlier than 40,000 years ago, we're in the initial Upper Paleolithic, which, based on the sites that we found, starts about 49 or 50,000 years ago. Each site that we have has only part of this initial Upper Paleolithic, so we have to look at all of them together and try to piece together what was part of the overall pattern, what is the difference through time, and what is the difference between different parts of the Near East. The two big arguments with the initial Upper Paleolithic are whether the Upper Paleolithic is something that arrived in the Near East, or into a particular region of the Near East, from somewhere else, or whether this is something that develops locally and that has connections to the Middle Paleolithic. You can also look at this argument as, did humans bring the Upper Paleolithic with them when they drove the Neanderthals out, or did humans settle alongside the Neanderthals and we both contributed to the creation of the Upper Paleolithic? When we look at all of the sites that we found, what we see in the very earliest stages of the initial Upper Paleolithic is the appearance of blades. This is one of the major changes that we see in the stone tools between the Middle Paleolithic and the Upper Paleolithic. You will remember from the last few weeks that Middle Paleolithic tools are from the Mousterian tool tradition and are often but not always made using the Levallois technique, which gives you a lot of large flakes that you can then use as tools, or that you can modify to make into more specific tools. There are other ways of making tools in the Mousterian, which can show up as a small part of the stone tools that we find on sites. One of these other techniques is making blades, which do show up a little bit across the Mousterian. By blades, I mean shaping the core, the parent rock, so that it has a long and narrow ridge along one side, which you then knock off so that you have a long, thin, usually straight bit of chipped stone that is sharp on both sides. This is what we call a blade. The big difference that we see in the stone tools between the middle and the upper Paleolithic is that we move from most of the tools being made based on flakes, most of which are Levallois, to most of the tools being made based on blades. If we look at these tools, both from their shape and from the way that they've been made, then we can see that the Middle Paleolithic and Upper Paleolithic show two really different ways of making tools. Therefore, from the tools, but also from other things, these are two different groups, and importantly, they're not related. However, if we look at the initial Upper Paleolithic, this is not always so simple. If we look at these initial sites from the Levant, from the Caucasus, and from the Zagros Mountains, and even further east, we see something similar. Blades and this bladey type way of making tools turn up as a dominant part of the stone tools even from the really early examples about 49,000 years ago. However, we get Mousterian tools, like Levallois flakes, also turning up within this new bladey way of making stone tools. When this was first noticed, some archaeologists argued that this must be a mixing of material between the middle and the upper Paleolithic layers in these caves. Or they argued that small rodents or other animals must have mixed up the material. Now, we do have one or two caves where we know that little furry animals have mixed things up. This is annoying, but it's already been done, and it's not like the animals knew what they were doing, so we just have to make do. But most of these caves do not have evidence of animals moving things around, and this is something that we specifically check for. We also get these Mousterian sorts of tools turning up in initial Upper Paleolithic layers at sites where there are no Middle Paleolithic layers underneath. Also, this keeps turning up at more and more sites. What does this mean? Well, I said that these initial Upper Paleolithic sites each only have part of the sequence. We don't know if this transition started at the same time in every part of the Near East. And from the dates we have, it looks like it might have started a tiny bit earlier in the Levant than in other areas. If we take all of the sites that we have from this transition and we line them up in time, it looks like the Mousterian or Levallois flakes and the flake points part of the stone tools gets less and less through time, and they are completely replaced by blades and blade points. We also see a change over time from the hunting of mostly big animals, like large deer, wild cattle, and wild horse-like animals called onagers, to hunting more medium-sized animals, like gazelle and smaller deer, but also with a little bit of wild cattle and onager, as well as a few smaller animals. This is why we think of these 10,000 or so years as a transition. We see a series of changes over thousands of years that take us from the Middle Paleolithic to the Upper Paleolithic. This is particularly the case in the Levant, where the Upper Paleolithic is often seen as something that grew out of local traditions. In other areas, such as in the Zagros, this is seen mostly as something that came in from other parts of the Near East, but which also slightly evolved in place. The difficulty is that we're looking at a 10,000 or more year transition, so there is a lot that can happen in that time, and there is a lot of the Near East where things may have happened differently. So it would be not all that surprising if one region of the Near East had the initial Upper Paleolithic evolving as a local thing out of earlier traditions, and then in other areas it moved in mostly formed and moved across the landscape and adapted and changed a bit in each region to form the regional Upper Paleolithic variations that we see later. One way of figuring out how the initial Upper Paleolithic got going would be to see who was living in the area at the time. If it's all Neanderthals, then that would kind of argue that they may have had some input. But if it's only humans around for quite a while, then that would suggest that Neanderthals didn't have much, if anything, to do with this first stage of the Upper Paleolithic. Well, we know that Levallois was a big part of Neanderthal tool traditions in the Middle Paleolithic. We also know that it was part of the human tool-making tradition during the Middle Paleolithic in both the Near East and in Africa. This has always complicated things, because it means that we cannot automatically see Levallois flakes as indicating Neanderthals, because we humans use this same technology as well. So it could be either Neanderthals or humans adding these Mousterian tools at initial Upper Paleolithic sites. Just like with the Middle Paleolithic, we need to rely on finding skeletons to figure out who was where when. Well, for a long time, we didn't really get all that lucky with skeletons from this initial part of the Upper Paleolithic. We had human skeletons from other parts of the Upper Paleolithic, and we've had a fair few Neanderthal skeletons from the later parts of the Middle Paleolithic. But in between, all we had were a few fragments of bone that could not really be separated between the two people species. In the last 5 years, though, things have gotten both a little bit easier and also a lot more complicated. We have found some bones, both from humans and from Neanderthals. In the Levant, specifically in the southern parts of the Levant, where humans coming out of Africa would have first come into contact with Neanderthals, we've had a few interesting discoveries. This is the area where we know that Neanderthals were living in the later stages of the Middle Paleolithic, and where they seem not only to have been doing reasonably well, but it looks like the population may actually have been growing enough to change the way that Neanderthals were using the landscape. It looks now like they might have not been alone here for as long as we thought. We've recently found a new batch of Neanderthal skeletons at Amwoud Cave. Older excavations had found some before, but with the new excavations, we can get direct dates for the skeletons using the new OSL dating technique. These Neanderthals turned out to only be about 50,000 years old, which is just slightly older than the earliest initial Upper Paleolithic sites that we have in this same area. To make things more interesting, other new excavations just next door, at Chauvac Cave, found Middle Paleolithic layers which dated to only 45,000 years ago. Meaning that there was at least 5,000 years where both the Middle Paleolithic and the Upper Paleolithic were happening in the same region at the same time. Or, in other words, it looks like we definitely overlapped with Neanderthals, at least in this part of the Near East, for a while. We have also found a foot and some teeth from Manot Cave, which also date to about 45 to 42,000 years ago. So we know that we have human remains from within these initial Upper Paleolithic layers, further proving that we and the Neanderthals were probably both living in this same area for a while. To make things even more interesting, excavations at Manot Cave have found a human skull, or at least most of a human skull, which turned out to be 55,000 years old. These recent discoveries have given us a different idea about what we think might have happened in the move from the Middle to the Upper Paleolithic. If we have human remains in the Levant from 55,000 years ago, that suggests one of two things. Either the initial Upper Paleolithic started a few thousand years earlier than we know, and we just haven't found these really early sites or haven't been able to get good dates for them because they're outside of radiocarbon dating, or the first humans to move out of Africa and to live in the Levant might not have used the blade-based tool technology that we associate with the Upper Paleolithic. That might have come later. Out of these two ideas, it's the second one that's currently getting the most attention at the moment. We have been pretty good at trying to get dates for sites, especially for the initial stage of the Upper Paleolithic, and we have the ability to use both radiocarbon dating and OSL on the same excavations in order to check and make sure that we have the right dates. This first argument would suggest that we have somehow missed a few thousand years of Upper Paleolithic. It's not impossible. But in the Levant, where Paleolithic research has been a big thing for 100 years, it's maybe not super likely. The second argument has gotten traction in archaeology at the moment, largely because of the human skull from Manot Cave. If we humans were living in the Levant for 5,000 years or so before we changed our way of doing things enough for it to register as the beginnings of the Upper Paleolithic, then the only possible answer is that we must have been using stone tool technology much more like the stuff that we humans had in the Middle Paleolithic, and the change over to blades must have happened later. From this point of view, the Upper Paleolithic was not something that humans developed and then brought with them as we moved into the Near East, driving out the Neanderthals. Instead, the Upper Paleolithic is something that happened as a result of several thousand years of humans living alongside Neanderthals in the Near East. Regardless of whether this was as friendly neighbors sharing stories or as competitors, or both. From this argument, it was the interaction between the two groups that led to an extra emphasis on movement, technology, and self-expression in humans, which expanded and became the Upper Paleolithic. In other words, these changes in technology, and other changes that we'll talk about next week, were the result of the beginnings of the Upper Paleolithic, and not the cause. This maybe would not explain what ultimately happened to the Neanderthals, but it does make for an interesting way to look at the gradual replacement of Levallois flakes by blades and blade tools, the gradual changes in hunting, and the long overlap in at least some parts of the Near East between humans and Neanderthals. We may or may not have gone to war. Looking at it this way, it actually doesn't matter. It was the living together in the same landscape that would have given both species the incentive to sharpen up the technology in order to outdo the neighbors at hunting and gathering, and that eventually led to us humans beginning a technological arms race which would spread and improve for a few thousand years before we ultimately stood alone on the planet as the only people species left. Thank you for listening to the Prehistory Podcast. If you have any questions or comments, you can reach me at prehistorypodcast@gmail.com. If you would like to see any of the technology or the places that I've talked about today, you can find these on the website at prehistorypodcast.com. If you have enjoyed this episode, please give the podcast a rating and a review on your platform of choice to help others find it. And come back and join us next week when we look at what life was like in the Upper Paleolithic.